21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
I'm on a mission for the King. He told me to smile, and he told me to sing. And I can't get around here doing my own thing. For I'm on a mission for the King.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is the alleged Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD hanging out in this part of the universe. And since there's so many levels of this universe, it's hard to identify which universe we're talking about, but we give it a try. And our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Jake Bryant. There goes Slim and the Supreme Angels. Boy, oh, I'd love singing with them. Now, this past Wednesday, the last Major League Negro League baseball player in Maryland, Bert Simmons, left his physical body and moved into the heaven worlds. He was a pitcher for the Baltimore Light Giants and also an outfielder. And it's not a coincidence that this hour's guest is Bob Luke, who authored the Baltimore Light Giants, Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. This is a gorgeous book. It not only looks good, it reads well, and there's a lot of stuff in here that I knew very little about. And that's after about almost 20 years of paying attention to this stuff. One of the best known teams in the old Negro Leagues, the Light Giants of Baltimore, featured some of the outstanding African American players of the day. Sociologist and baseball writer Bob Luke narrates the untold story of the team and its interaction with the city and its people during the long years of segregation. Based on interviews with former players and Baltimore residents, articles from the black press of the time, and archival documents, and illustrated with previously unpublished photographs, I really enjoyed that. The Baltimore Light Giants recounts a barrier-breaking team's successes, its failures, and its eventual demise. Bob Luke is also the author of Dean of Umpires, the biography of Bill McGowan, 1896 to 1954, and Willie Wells, El Diablo of the Negro Leagues. Gosh, Rudy, I haven't read that one. Boy, I should have. Are you with us, Bob?
I am here, Dr. Bob.
I see you over there, hanging out over there. But when did Willie Wells come out?
Willie Wells came out in 2007.
2007.
Spring of 2007, University of Texas Press.
Have you ever thought about doing a book on Leon Day?
You know, that thought has occurred to me. I know you were very active in getting him into the Hall of Fame, and he was a longtime player with the Newark Eagles and put in a year or two with the Elite Giants and was a major force in Baltimore.
Well, I hope you consider it because it really needs to be done. It's a story that I think most, especially those who love Negro League baseball, would love to learn about. Now, there are many challenges that the Negro Leagues had to face that Major League White Baseball had mastered. One such example was the Negro National League Championship for 1948. Now, the reason why I'm laughing, this is one of the things I wish I would have known so many years ago. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was a five-game series between the Powerhouse Homestead Grays and the Elite Giants, and the Homestead Grays won the first two games, and if they won the third game, they won the championship. The third game ran late. It was tied in the eighth inning. There was an 11 o'clock curfew facing both teams. The Grays scored a couple of runs, got ahead of the Giants, so the Giants just stalled, and thought if the game went past the 11 o'clock curfew, the umpires would call the game, and the score would revert to a tie, and the game would not count. But they miscalculated. Turns out that the umpire should have told both teams that as long as the ninth inning started before 11 o'clock, the game would count. And it turned out the president of the league had to intercede to determined that the Eli Giants' unsportsmanlike behavior meant they had to forfeit the game, and so the Grays won the series 3-0. But a lot of it revolved around the umpire really not knowing the rules.
And, it's a problem.
You would not see that in the major leagues. The umpires in the majors were well-trained, and particularly in championship series, there would have been at least one umpire on the field who would have known the rules.
Yeah.
But as you say, that was only one of the challenges faced by Negro League teams.
Yeah, other challenges were day-to-day varieties, such as the coaches, the scouts, the farm system. Would you give a few examples of those kind of problems, of the coaches, scouts, and farm systems?
Well, in the Negro Leagues, for a variety of reasons, didn't have the financial resources of the majors, and so they did not have managers and coaches and scouts. They all did that in addition to playing the game. So you had player managers. If anybody taught a young rookie how to play, it was another player who sort of took an interest in him, but there was no organized training, scouting capabilities in the Negro Leagues. They just didn't have the resources and the manpower to do it. So they struggled. Of course, they struggled with discrimination. They had hard times finding ballparks at times to play in. They had small rosters of 16, 17 players instead of the 25 they traveled by bus over two-lane highways, drove through all hours of the day and night. And you'd think they would be exhausted and worn out by the middle of the season. But truth be told, they played excellent baseball, and in many instances they played better baseball than the majors. Mm-hmm. They would frequently, the Eli Giants and other Negro League teams would frequently beat a major league team.
So they didn't have scouts, they had a kind of managers, I guess you'd call it. But, you know, what kind of, and then there were the owners. Now, this is a real select group here.
They were.
Yeah, tell us about some of the owners here.
Well, the owners were, by and large, numbers runners. They owned clubs. They invested in real estate. They sort of operated below the radar, at least below the white radar in the running numbers, where a lot of them made their money, was, of course, illegal activity. But in the African-American community, they were considered really pillars of the society. Running numbers was one avenue open to blacks in those days to make a lot of money. And the Wilson, who owned the Eli Giants, had the Paradise Club in Nashville, Tennessee, was sort of the numbers king there. And so they generated their money what they could that way and contributed to the black community. Like Tom Wilson was president of the Elks Club in Nashville. He supported various causes in Baltimore. They were in kind of their own world, making do as best they could.
Now, he was he also the president of the Negro National League?
He was.
Yeah.
A
lot of controversy there, and learned a great deal. I mean, a great deal, especially about the Effa Manley and his relationship. That was really quite extraordinary, that she would challenge him so many times and finally got her way, I guess, from that standpoint. Now, during those years of 1938 to 51, when the Elites played in Baltimore, what kind of relationships were there between the blacks and the whites in Baltimore?
Well, that was a time of very heavy-duty segregation and discrimination in Baltimore, and it was really two mirror societies. Every institution in the white community, the black community, had its own institution, its own school system, its own set of banks, its own funeral parlors, restaurants, clubs, et cetera. And with the exception of maybe a neighborhood called Old West and Pennsylvania Avenue, where a lot of clubs were, where the jazz greats played, whites and blacks didn't mix a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
One of the contributions to black society that the Giants made was that within Bugle Field, where they played most of their home games, that was a sanctuary for blacks. They could go to the games just like they would go to church, and they could be themselves and let their hair down, and then they would not encounter the kind of discrimination and insults and one thing and another that they put up with in their day-to-day life in the city.
Yeah, so the ball games were a kind of a sanctuary. As you noted on page 12 of for the city's African Americans, there wasn't very much they really could do during that time period. Now, you mentioned the Old West. Now, we're not talking about Colorado, Arizona. But tell us about the area referred to as Old West, where in 1940, 125,000 of Baltimore's 166,000 blacks lived.
Right. But it was a community in sort of in northwest Baltimore that was known for wide streets, large homes, and somehow attracted three-quarters of the professional black population of the city of Baltimore. The NAACP leaders lived there. Thurgood Marshall lived there. Most of the black lawyers and doctors lived there. And it was a kind of a self-contained professional community. I mean, there were pockets of slum housing here and there, but it was, as one person told me, in Old West, all the kids had the absolute best teachers because, unfortunately, that was the only place blacks could teach.
Mm-hmm.
They really didn't teach in the white school system. So it was a, and then when, ironically, when integration came to pass, that whole black society disintegrated in Old West. People who could afford to moved out into the suburbs. So it died about the same time that the Eli Giants did.
So that Pennsylvania Avenue then was the social mecca of the Old West. Boy, I wish I would have. I mean, I lived in close to that area. Unfortunately, I wish I would have been more conscious. But what are you going to do when you're 5 years old? I mean, you know, you can't.
I didn't know.
You don't know what's going on. It looked good to me anyway. I love the way they dressed. I mean, I just loved it. Now, in getting Baltimore's black community to support the Eli Giants, we had Richard D. Powell to lead a campaign. Tell us about this man, Dick Powell, and how successful was he in getting the black community to support the Eli Giants?
Well, he really took the bit in his teeth when he heard the Eli Giants were thinking of coming to Baltimore. He was in his early 20s at that time. He was doing a variety of odd jobs. But he took upon himself to go around to the black professional societies and the African American newspaper and get them to put up some money and encourage people to go to the games. And he made it possible for the players when they were in town to live in private homes where they could have nice accommodations and home cooked meals, and they didn't have to live in these kind of rundown hotels. He got a lot of newspaper publicity going. And then once the team came to Baltimore, he served as, in a whole number of capacities through 1951, as a reporter. He wrote a lot of stories about the team. He ended up being the team's vice president at the end in 1950 and 51. And his daughter, Barbara Powell Golden, who lives in Glendale, Maryland, was very supportive about the book and allowed me to look through her father's papers and photographs. And that's where a lot of the photographs in the book come from.
Uh-huh.
So it's a marvelous collection, and she's done a wonderful job of keeping it together. And it's a real treasure that she has. So she kind of continues that tradition that her father started.
Well, I'm so glad that she gave you access to this, obviously knowing what a professional person you were in this work, having already done some major works in this area. And that really makes a difference because here you, and also in this book, you have some line drawings, one of Bugle Field, as it appeared in 1942. And I remember when the first time I met with Bert Simmons, we went out to the location of Bugle Field. Not that it looked
it was a little different.
So he was trying to paint a picture of it to me, and the thing that always fascinated me, and I'm going to ask you a question a little later on, was that outfield. That mm-hmm. outfield. I think you have some photographs of one of the players. Maybe it could have been one of the coaches, too. No, it wasn't a coach. Sitting
Oh, yeah.
On a little hill, looks like. Is that the actual hill that came up to the fence? Because when you ran out, I don't recall whether it was left field, right field, but near the fence in the outfield, they had a hill that you had to run up.
Well, they did. A slight hill. That right.
That's dangerous.
That, yeah.
That was that could be really dangerous.
Why they had that, I'm not sure. Then that the picture is actually of George Scales.
That's correct. Yes,
who was a player manager various times with the Giants.
He was a pretty tough character.
He was a very tough character. A lot of those guys are very tough characters, right? I mean,
some of the stories here are just great. Just great. Well, look, we need to take our first break. The hour with our guest, Bob Luke, the Baltimore Light Giants Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, the Johns Hopkins University Press. Oh, you'll love this book. It's a gorgeous. It's really gorgeous, and the information is just priceless. You can click the link to order it on the front page of 21st Century Radio or call 1-800-537-5487, 1-800-537-5487. And one of the things that you're also going to love is the appendices. This has got one of the best appendices I've ever seen, with the standings of the Light Giants from 38 to 51. It's got an excellent index. I'm a Virgo, so I like those indexes, and I like those references. And the footnotes. Oh, you love those. We'll be back with our guest, Bob Luke, in just a few minutes.
Did you know that Talk Radio 680, WCBM?
UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com is the place to go to check out my latest book, a beautiful gallery of over 70 illustrations with many in color, plus ones we didn't have room for in the print version. Read some of the intriguing stories and other content we cut from the book for lack of space. Order an autographed copy online along with coffee mugs, pins, medallions, and other books available only at UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com. See the reviews of my latest book from Willie Nelson, Shirley MacLaine, George Norrie, Graham Hancock, Stanley Krippner, and many more. UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com. Check it out today.
What are the seven things you should know before trying holistic health care? Find out at the Rusco Mansion's Basics of Self-Healing on Sunday, September the 13th from 1 to 4 p.m. On the web at Ruscom, RUSCOMBE.org, Ruscom.org, or call 410-367-7300. The Rusco Mansion is the oldest and largest wellness center on the East Coast and is home to 30 licensed practitioners of acupuncture, massage, herbal and nutritional counseling, energy healing, homeopathy, and more. Meet them in person at the 25th anniversary open house on the 13th of September, 1 to 4 p.m. Call 410-367-7300. Healthy meals, activities for kids, yoga by the lily pond, and herbal tastings at the Rusco Mansion. 410-367-7300, September the 13th, free event. Learn the seven tips to find the best natural therapy for you. 410-367-7300.
This is Hall of Famer Monty Irvin, reminding you to stay tuned to 21st Century Radio's Hieronymus and Company for updates on Negro League baseball stars.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Monty is going to be joining us sometime in the future on his book that came out in 2007. Our guest for the rest of the show is Bob Luke, the Baltimore Light Giants Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, the Johns Hopkins University Press. Boy, they got a great one here. Yes, indeed. Boy, it's not just the footnotes and the appendices, and all that, but it also, take a look at this. Take a look at these pages on suggested reading. That's right. Not suggestive reading, but suggested reading. That really, and you know, I love to find new references in this area. Great job, Bob. Now,
thanks.
Finding a ballpark where the Light Giants could play in Baltimore. What were some of the problems they faced, and where did they play?
Well, Tom Wilson at first tried to get the Eli Giants into the old Oriole Park, but the owners didn't want blacks playing in the park, so they were not able to get in 1938. But in 1939, for some reason, one of the booking agents was able to get some games for the Eli Giants into Oriole Park, and so they started playing there and attracting decent-sized crowds, and it looked like it was going to be a very profitable run for the Giants. They would play there when the Orioles were on the road. But unfortunately, there was a small fight in the stands after the 1942 opening day game, and the citizens got up in arms, and so the owners reneged on their deal and basically kicked the Eli Giants out of Oriole Park, and which meant the team had to go to East Baltimore where Bugle Field was, which was a small wooden grandstand ball field, only sat about 6,000 people, while Oriole Park would take 15 or so thousand. So for most of their time up until 1950, they played in Bugle Field when they played in Baltimore. Of course, when they played on the road, like a lot of the other Negro League teams, they would be booked in oftentimes into major league parks like Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds and Scheib Field, Ebbets Park, so Ebbets Field and so forth. And so on the road, they made more money than oftentimes they did in Baltimore.
Old Oriole Ballpark, I grew up on 2930 Greenmount Avenue.
Well, that was right there.
It was on the alleyway. I mean, I didn't live in the alley. I mean, it was the alley behind that very large cylindrical, cinder block wall back there. And you noted in your book that, was it Buck Leonard? Was it he that hit the ball out of that park and on top of a roof in that area?
Yeah, I believe it was.
I've often wondered after reading that. I wonder if it was the roof, because our house, I found this out recently. My dad, who was a coach in sandlot ball, my dad used to have people sit on top of the roof. And that's what they would do. They'd set up on the top of the roof, watch the game, and sometimes the balls would come over there.
Okay.
But I don't know if it was – and that would have been the left – no, that would have been the right field of Old Oriole Ballpark. So I don't know if that's where Buck Leonard – but he was left-handed, wasn't he? He might have. I just wonder. I wonder if my, because my dad introduced me to Negro League baseball, and he told me this
oh,
was,
he did.
Yeah, he was the one that took me up to Pennsylvania and said, "You want to see real baseball?" And it was amazing, because it was a black team versus a white team, a coal mining town up there, and what I saw was unbelievable in the sense that if they got a man on first base, Negro League team got a man on first base, it was like Little League, because They always stole bases. They were just, they would move.
Ran.
You know, you got him on first base, he's going to steal second. He's going to steal third. And if they can, they'll steal home. And it was an amazing thing to watch that. I don't know who I was watching. All I knew is they were black. Now, the Elite Giants came to Baltimore in 1938. What kind of team did they field back in 1938?
Well, in 1938, it was mostly young Southern boys who made up the team that came from Alabama, Mississippi, the Carolinas, in their late teens, early 20s. They had the senior leadership of the team was Biz Mackey, who at that time had been in Negro League ball for about 20 years. He was the catcher. He was the one who then developed Roy Campanella, who in 1938 was 16 when he joined the Eli Giants and was the only player born north of the Mason-Dixon line. Campanella came from Philadelphia. So you had Campanella just beginning his run, but you had Biz Mackey as really the star of the team, and he was the manager, player manager for the first year. He really kind of helped hold it all together.
Do you recall whether or not he finally made it into the Hall of Fame?
Biz Mackey did, yes. He did.
Was that 2006?
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
When like 17 Negro Leaguers made it into the Hall of Fame. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was really something.
He should have gone in earlier.
Yeah, certainly. A lot of them should have gone in. Yeah, and it was all your fault that they didn't.
Yeah. Right.
We got to blame somebody around here. So who were our good pitchers at that time?
One outstanding pitcher was Andrew Porter, nicknamed Pullman. Andrew Pullman Porter, a Southern boy who played for the Ely Giants through the 1940s with a couple of years out down into Mexico where he could make a little more money than he could in the States. And, of course, you had Joe Black toward the end of the Giants' stay in Baltimore. He joined the Ely Giants in about 1949. Well, he did before World War II. He first joined the team as a shortstop, but they changed him to a pitcher after the war, and he went on to play with the Dodgers and became the first black pitcher to win a World Series game when he beat the Yankees in maybe the 1952 World Series. And, of course, Leon Day was there for 1 year in 1949 after a long career with the Newark Eagles. Bob Rombe was another well-known pitcher for the Ely Giants. So they had some good pitchers.
I think one of Leon's favorite pitchers was Bill Byrd.
Oh, yes.
Wasn't Bill Byrd, he was a spitter. He was a spitter, wasn't he?
He was probably their best pitcher.
Yeah.
And he threw the spitball. He was the last Negro leaguer who could legally throw a spitball. I think a lot of them threw a spitball, but he threw his legally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He played a long time for the Elite Giants.
He did.
Yeah. Now, the Baltimore Elite Giants had two championship teams, 39 and 49. Of course, there's always controversy here.
That's
I laughed a lot reading your book, by the way. Who were the players that put the 39 lights on top, and what kind of controversy surrounded their winning the Rupert Cup?
Well, the Rupert Cup was established by New York Yankees owner. That was for the Negro League team that won four out of seven special games played in Yankee Stadium. And the Ely Giants in 1939 did win the Rupert Cup. And some thought because they won the Rupert Cup, they also won the championship unfairly. But that was not the case. They also won the championship, even though there was, at the time, some controversy over whether it was the league championship or not. But it truly was. They did win the championship, even though the Homestead Grays sometimes had counted that as a championship year for themselves. But it also sort of pointed up the lack of organization in the Negro Leagues, that these kind of issues were not always squarely decided and records were not always well kept. And it's hard to put together histories of the game. And it, sometimes standings, you know, during the season were in doubt. So it was... it was excellent baseball. It was a wonderful social event, but it was also disorganized to the extent that it was sometimes hard to know for sure who, for instance, won a championship. It became a controversy in 1939.
And there's still controversy over the 49 Elite Giants. This is something I was not aware of. What kind of controversy surrounded that championship in 1949?
1949, I think they pretty well nailed that one. They won, they were playing against the Chicago American Giants. And they beat the Giants at four straight games. I think it was two games in Baltimore, one in Chicago. And as a matter of fact, they played the third game in Bugle Field, and that turned out to be the last game ever played at Bugle Field. After that game was over and the teams moved on to Chicago for the fourth game, the owners of Bugle Field tore it down because they had sold it 2 years earlier to a publishing company who decided they wanted the property in 1949.
And then they moved to a smaller 2,000 seat stadium.
Right.
Well, it could be called a stadium, but as you said in your book, it really wasn't any stadium, but it was very small.
Very small. Westport Ballpark.
Westport, that's it. That's right.
Down there by Russell and Bush Street. Was built in kind of a quick, haphazard manner, and the Ely Giants called that home for 1950 and in the first half of the 51 season when they finally had to call it quits and the team went back to Nashville.
Now, there are some heroes here in regards to well, such as Mayor Theodore R. McKeldin. At least he's hero to me. What part did he play in the equal treatment of blacks in Baltimore?
Well, a large part. He was elected mayor twice in Baltimore, and during his term as mayor, he would make a practice of going to black churches. Sometimes he would talk, sometimes he would just listen, but he got very active in improving housing for blacks. He set up a housing commission, and I think it was the first integrated housing commission in the city of Baltimore. He oftentimes threw out the first pitch at Bugle Field, and he brought with him at various times African-American politicians who would be the catcher. So here would be the white mayor throwing a pitch to the black catcher, and maybe the police commissioner was at bat and taking a swing. Mm-hmm. And when Oriel Park burned down in on a July 4th weekend, 1944, it was McKeldin who stepped in and said that the Orioles, rather than usurping Bugle Field from the Eli Giants, could play in if I've got my stadium names correct, Municipal Stadium, mm-hmm. which previously had just been used for football, meaning that the Elites could continue to use Bugle Field. But McKeldin was a strong advocate for equal treatment, and he made that known through his interaction with the Eli Giants as well as with the neighborhood associations and the general political structure in the city of Baltimore.
Did he serve two terms as governor?
I think he did. I think he was also governor when the Chesapeake Bay Bridge was built.
Yes. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. 59, I think it was. Yeah.
Now, of the 427,926 things that I learned from your book, one of them, Jackie Robinson, made his first appearance as a minor leaguer in Baltimore. He was with Montreal then, I believe.
Correct. Yep.
How did Baltimore fans react to Jackie Robinson?
Well, I guess they reacted as you might expect. They reacted very differently along racial lines. The blacks stormed the field at the end of a game, his first game, and paraded Robinson around the field, while the white fans hooted and jeered at him throughout the entire game. And a group of white fans showed up at the door to the players, the Royals' locker room, wanting to get at Jackie Robinson and do him harm.
Yeah.
And the police had to come and disband that group of whites and get him out of the way. And Robinson was quoted as saying that Baltimore was the toughest city for him to play in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When he played in New Jersey, for instance, he didn't really have these problems in the minor leagues. But he said Baltimore was the toughest city he played in, minor or major league.
He said, the nasty things Baltimore people threw at me hardened me to the point where the spiking was rather easy to take, because he got spiked a lot. I knew I was coming into the South, and I suppose I was preparing for just about anything, but that Baltimore, holy gee.
Yeah.
Too bad. I'm sorry, Jackie. But what was the reason why Tom Wilson's tenure as the Negro National League president finally ended in 1947?
Well, Effa Manley, as you mentioned earlier, Effa Manley, who was the, you might think of her as the business manager of the Newark Eagles, a team that her husband Abe owned, but she was a driving force to try and bring better business practices and organization to the Negro Leagues. One of her efforts was to oust Wilson as president because he was kind of a hail fellow, well-met, laid-back, let-things-roll kind of league president and did very little to improve the fortunes of the league. And Effa Manley, each and every year, tried to get him out by nominating somebody else to take his position, but she could not gather enough votes of the other owners to do that until January of 1947, when finally enough of the other owners decided it was time to become better organized for one reason, to incur favor with the major leagues, as they were beginning to see the handwriting on the wall that as integration of the majors was beginning to take place, the Negro leagues were going to be diminished, and so they needed to support the major leagues. Hopefully, with some better business practices, they could get that. And so in 1947, F. Amana succeeded in ousting Wilson and replacing him with a minister, John Johnson, from Harlem, who brought the leadership and organization that the league needed.
Well, when we return, after we award a copy of this book to one of our listeners, when we return, we'll talk about the dissolution of the Negro National League and the loss of the Light Giants to Baltimore, and what happened to Negro League baseball after Jackie Robinson, Campanella, Joe Black, and numbers of others went into the white majors. We'll be back with Bob Luke, the Baltimore Light Giants, Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, the Johns Hopkins University Press. Click the link to order it on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or call 1-800-537-5487. In my opinion, this is the best book I have ever read on the Negro Leagues.
Right here on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Next week on 21st Century Radio. What is the Woodstock vision? Why do so many people see this event as generation-defining? Plus, a visit with the sister of Jimi Hendrix on his electrifying performance at Woodstock. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM. If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at thesellingwell.com. That's thesellingwell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit thesellingwell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890, thesellingwell.com. Oh, how would you like to win a free 21st Century Radio library of books and magazines and other stuff, including the book, The Baltimore Alight Giants, Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, by Bob Luke, our guest this hour. Published by the Johns Hopkins University Press, 1-800-537-5487. If you can answer this question, you might be able to take home the whole library. What was the name of our final guest on 21st Century Radio last week? Just tell us the name of our final guest on 21st Century Radio last week, and if you can, you'll be the winner if you do it first, but you got to qualify. Here's how to do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
My name is Stanley Glenn from the Philadelphia Stars baseball team of the Negro National League. This is 21st Century Radio, and I'm very privileged to be in this spot.
Oh, that's one of my favorite songs on the whole planet, Sister Winona Carr. Way to go. Life is a ball game. All right, our guest is Bob Luke, the Baltimore Light Giants, Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, Johns Hopkins University Press, 1-800-537-5487. Oh, gosh, Bob, what brought about the dissolution of the Negro National League?
Well, ironically enough, Dr. Bob, it was the integration of the major leagues. Once Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson and Don Newcomb and Joe Black, and then others followed, and Larry Doby went to the Cleveland Indians, and Satchel Paige went, and then all of the stars from the Negro Leagues ended up in the majors, and that really just decimated the talent level amongst the Negro League teams. And a lot of the black fans changed their loyalties from Negro League baseball to Major League Baseball so they could see their heroes playing in the majors, which they had hoped would happen for years and years, that the whole black community had been pushing for the integration of Negro League baseball for many years. And to see it finally come to pass was a real milestone in the black community. So as the fans went to see the Major League games, fewer went to the Negro League games, and they just didn't have enough fan support to continue, and many of the teams folded. The Eli Giants unfortunately folded in 51, and the Newark Eagles had closed up shop in 1948, as had the Homestead Grays, a real powerhouse team for years and years. Mm-hmm. So it was just once the way was open for blacks to play in the majors and the minors, there really wasn't any need for the Negro Leagues.
But when Major League Baseball wanted to purchase the Light Giants players to play in the white major leagues, what kind of problems did Dick Powell have?
Well, he was very supportive of getting Junior Gilliam and Joe Black into the majors, and he helped Gilliam get a tryout with the Chicago Cubs that unfortunately didn't work out. But he finally got the Dodgers interested in Junior Gilliam and Joe Black, got them signed. But then he ran into the same problem that fans in Baltimore were going to Philadelphia, Washington, even as far as New York to see Jackie Robinson, Monty Irvin, Joe Black play in the majors. And mm-hmm. They just weren't coming out. And so Dick Powell had to, he tried to sell the team to a white restaurateur in Baltimore. That didn't work out. So he sold the team to a group in Nashville, Tennessee, where it originally started in 1921. And Dick Powell wanted to stay in the game, and he wrote letters to the Dodgers and several other major league teams offering his services as a scout, and you know, here was a guy who had all kinds of experience and talent, was not able to land a job with any team as a scout.
Oh, my.
And so he ended up working with the Social Security Administration in Baltimore for 20 years or so.
Then the Light Giants wanted to rent Memorial Stadium to play their games. What kind of problems did Dick face in regards to this?
Well, the board that controlled Memorial Stadium did allow them to rent the stadium for maybe 7 games, where they had put in originally 17, for, you know, asked to play 17 games in the Memorial Stadium. But the board allowed the 7 games under certain conditions, but then put out a statement saying that they only allowed a few dates because it was not the custom for the Eli Giants to represent Baltimore as it was the custom for the Baltimore Orioles to represent Baltimore. So, you know, they continued with the racial slurs and put-downs.
And the cost of running the stadium was considerably higher than I understand.
Yes. All right, good point. Yes, no, they charged the Eli Giants 5 or 6 times the amount of rent that they charged the Baltimore Orioles.
Another thing you brought up that I was not conscious of, when white players wanted to play in the Negro Leagues, they had difficulties. Who presented those problems?
They did, yes, right. The three white players signed on with the Chicago team, but when the Chicago team got to Birmingham, Alabama, Bull Connor, who people remember from the, you know, nightsticks and police dogs and that kind of thing in the Montgomery civil rights fight days, Bull Connor would not let the white players take the field because they did not have integrated anything, including baseball, in Birmingham, Alabama. They could play in Chicago and Newark and places, but not in the South.
Yeah, yeah. Now, here's another thing I was not conscious of. Really showing my ignorance here, but I guess that's the reason why I had to read your book. Why did the NAACP oppose the St. Louis Browns in coming to Baltimore?
Well, it was an interesting story in that this was in 1954 when the Browns were coming to Baltimore, and the hotels would not allow blacks to sleep in the hotels. They could eat in the hotels and meet in the hotels, but they could not sleep in the hotels. And so the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, who was then the executive director in New York, sent a telegram to Will Herridge, president of the American League, asking him to use his influence to help get the hotels integrated in Baltimore, all to no avail.
Yeah.
And so the team came, the Browns came anyhow, and the few black players, I think there were two that first year, had to stay in private homes or in black hotels in the city. Could not stay with their team.
I'm trying to remember. Was Durham, Joe Durham, I believe.
I would have to go back and look that
Well,
up.
Yes, Joe Durham.
Right.
But there was another one, Jehosie J. Hurd. Hurd, he just recently passed on, didn't he? Or was it Joe that just recently passed on? About a year or so ago, a long struggle he had in trying to be compensated for something never came about. The democratization of the national pastime came too late for most Baltimore-like Giants.
Right.
There's a wonderful section in here, as far as I was concerned, on page 139, dealing with how the players felt about it. It's fairly bad of me to ask you this kind of question. I don't know how you're going to remember all this stuff. You know, if people ask me questions about my book on the radio, I can't remember a lot of it. But can you remember what Butch McCord had to say about that particular experience?
He was very angry. He compared it to slavery.
Yeah.
And he was very angry that he never made the majors, and that others like him didn't make the majors. He played in the minor leagues and amassed a wonderful record, hit over 300, was an excellent fielder, but never got the call for the majors.
Yeah, Joe Black was pretty bitter as well.
He was another bitter. Yes,
yeah,
he was.
Really.
And he made a statement in his autobiography. He said at that time that he hated whites.
Yeah,
because the white scouts told him blacks did not play organized baseball.
Mm. This is a great book. This really is. And I do hope you consider writing the book on Leon Day, because if you do that as well as this, or even close to this, Leon will finally be understood, because there's still a lot of information around a few exaggerations, as usually happens in this kind of area. But I really enjoyed reading it. It's not only a good read, but I can't overemphasize that the appendices, the year-to-year standings, the index, the suggested reading are the kind of things that I think our listeners would really enjoy. Thank you for joining us, Bob.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Again, the Baltimore Light Giants, Sport and Society in the Age of Negro League Baseball, Johns Hopkins University Press. Call 1-800-537-5487. 1-800-537-5487.
Names in talk on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Baltimore.
From ABC News, I'm Brad Wheatless.